Committee is called to order. It's Friday, March 30, 2012. Time is 8 o'clock. Reminding ourselves to turn off our cell phones. We're getting good at that. Present are Representative Feige, Representative Seaton, Representative Peggy Wilson, and myself, Representative Alan Dick. We do have a quorum. And we have three items on our agenda today. A first order of business is Lauren Birch, Southeast Island School District, which is an REAA, a presentation by the Alaska Tech Prep Consortium, and HB 352, Resource Development Curriculum. Superintendent Birch, are you online with us?
No, he's in the room, sir.
Oh. Well, forgive me, sir. What? I would have introduced myself. Good to have you.
Thank you. This is Lauren Birch with Southeast Island School District.
Excuse me, is it Warren or Lauren?
Lauren.
Lauren. Thank you, sir. Okay, go ahead with your presentation.
Okay. Well, we have a PowerPoint, which isn't particularly professional or useful in many regards, but we'll bounce through that quickly and then move on. But I'd like to thank you very much for allowing us the opportunity to talk about our district. You know, we live in an enormous state. The needs are so different, and districts are so different that it's, you know, it's complicated at best. I don't profess to be a particular expert on education in Alaska. I like to think I'm relatively sharp at what I do with mine, and so I can speak to that. And I don't begin to suggest that I have a better sense of what needs to be done than people in your seat, and I appreciate all you guys do for education. And to be quite honest, I due to cost and the energy of it, you know, we're pretty bad about letting other districts carry our weight and trusting that the legislature will do their best for us. And I believe you always have. So we don't get out much, and I probably survive better by doing that. We also have a packet for you when we're done that probably isn't very politically correct, and it's coming from my perspective, and I hope it's of some use to you. And if there's anything you can glean for that, please have at it. But we have a number of issues that keep, you know, and there's a few elephants in the room for us and for you too, probably there that we'll talk about. But anyway, a quick shot through here. Our legislative priorities this year were getting into greenhouses and wood-fired boilers. It's extremely let me go to the next one, I suppose. It's very difficult to heat schools and keep the electricity on with the power costs we all know in rural sites. Going to wood-fired boilers has been kind of a no-brainer. It cut down to the fuel cost, and be quite honest, if I didn't save a dime on fuel, it creates jobs in the community. Someone's got to cut that wood. We have a staggering expense if you have a kid's. I mean, if they actually won in basketball, I'd be a wreck, because then you got to go to state regionals. You got 20 kids, you got to move around. I mean, I live in mortal fear that eventually, you know, we'd like to stay in the top half of the bottom third. Otherwise, you can't afford it. Our poverty rate, you know, seeing one of these slides a minute is, you know, staggering. You know, it's 70% or something, and you're putting a terrible burden on parents, and we can't afford to pay for that kind of stuff. So kids have to raise money. And I have, just from my own background, I have an aversion to giving money to kids just because they're kids. I like to see them earn it. So we expect our kids to help with that firewood. You know, we have them painting schools. In a couple of schools, we even have them doing most of the custodial work to earn money for what they want to do. You know, and it works pretty well for us. I mean, we're building a second floor in a bus barn, and kids are in there. You know, when you got wet 2x6s moving around, they can move them just as well as a guy's making $20 an hour. And they want to do it, and they're proud of it, and they appreciate their schools more when they're the ones running the vacuum cleaner and painting the walls. A lot less stuff goes on the floor when they're the one that's going to be cleaning it up later. So. Anyway, and the greenhouses are a huge deal for us. Dying to get to that because, you know, we have school lunch programs, but in small districts, and you must hear from other places, it's physically impossible to make that come out even remotely close to paying for itself. We lose 100. I have 10 schools, or 9 schools, with the 8 of them being around 10 kids. The biggest one has 75, scattered over a huge geographic area, trying to get milk to a small site that gets only plain service. And we lose $100,000 a year in the food program, but it's intensely important. We didn't have one when I first worked in the district. Attendance changed remarkably as soon as we started having a program, because kids need to eat, and a lot of times they're not eating well at home. So, you know, we do it anyway because it's important, but, you know, we don't have vegetables. I can't afford a tomato for the school lunch program. So if we can get kids to grow it, you know, we can help the program, and we can also help kids raise money because they can sell it locally. I mean, most of our communities, only one of our communities even has a store. Otherwise, they ship it in or have to drive somewhere else to get it. So you're not really competing with local business. You know, it would be a good thing for them, too. You may not be able to get a kid to eat a Brussels sprout, but I guarantee from growing up myself and watching other kids in greenhouse stuff, if they grow it, they'll try it.
For the record, we've been joined by Representative Sisna. And also, Lauren, if you would just give us an idea geographically. I need a 50,000-foot view of your district. So if you just, because I'm not from Southeast, would you just give me the 50,000-foot view, and then we can get back down to the future housing.
Thank you. We're largely Prince of Wales Island. There are four districts on the island. We take up all the small area, all the small sites on the island, and we have Hyder within our boundary. We did have Myers Chuck went to Ketchikan with the borough, and we have Port Alexander on the bottom tip of Baranoff Island. It's covers a, you know, huge geographical area. Of course, about three of those have to be reached by plane. Five are on a road system that's generally open. And like I say, it's one, you know, we have about eight of them that are about 10 kids, and one that's about 75. Also on that island, you have Heidelberg, Kluwak, and Craig that are their own school districts.
Representative Wilson.
I might make a comment here. Port Alexander is in my district, and they had me come and speak at a graduation because there was two kids graduating. And so for me to go to that district and stay 2 hours for graduation and fly back, it cost me $1,000. So, you know, it's very expensive, and so they don't get to go in and out very often. You know, it's pretty amazing.
Thank you. And by kicking forward to some of those others, by any standard, we're I think hugely successful. Enrollment was dropping remarkably steeply. You can see on the left there, it's pretty hard to see the numbers, but you know, we're at about 160 kids or so at the moment. And that, if you can look at the little chart on the left, I mean, we have arrested that drop. And we do that, and the poverty rate has remained pretty constant, about 70%. But we've arrested that, and if you look at this one with the graduation rates, have made some, you know, by the red line is the state average, and the blue is ours, you know, with one teeny dip there below, and we could talk about that for if you may wanted to. But we're successful by any standard. We do it largely, and to sum it up, is that we take our parents and students very seriously and consider them like a consumer, you know, as a business. That's a radical change in education over the last 30 years that I've been in it. We want those parents involved in the hires, and when they have concerns about a teacher, they're engaged in what's going on with the curriculum and where we're going and why we're going there. If we mentioned with travel costs, it's staggeringly difficult to get kids out of a Port Alexander to go to anything. We concentrate a lot on activities that they can do over the internet. We have the top archery programs in the state. We've taken elementary, middle school, high school for the last 3 years in a row, continue to dominate. We do things like the IDEA technology project, where there were 36 first place awards in the state. Port Alexander, with a school of 11 kids, took a third of those. They had 11 first places from a school with 11 kids. I mean, to be concentrating on those kind of things where you can you don't necessarily have to travel. We've gotten into Wii, if anybody knows that. I mean, you can do people do PE programs with it anymore and do competitions between schools. Battle of Books, or, there's a lot of those things we can't really get to, like robotics we'd love to do and some of those others, because you've got to get them out somewhere to compete, and I can't send those kids to Juneau for that kind of stuff. And we do everything we can to cut costs. I mean, there's, and I listed it in the handout, but there's dozens of ways that we've found to reduce costs. We don't put teachers in jobs that don't need teachers. That's probably a big one. We contract services where we can. At the moment, just in the last few weeks, we started branching out towards other districts to see if we can't combine some of our administrative services. Since we're successful, you can't get a grant to save your life. Grants target failing school districts, schools, and at the federal level, larger districts now. It's pretty tough to get anything we haven't hit on a grant in forever. If we can combine services, we can, combine to get someone where they can chase a few grants and that kind of stuff. So, and in a small site with one school, you don't necessarily need their own superintendent. I know that's a very politically incorrect thing to say, but it's quite possible for us to combine services. But as far as that goes, I mean, there are several things that tangle us up in a terrible way. Tenure is the biggest one. I know it's difficult to even say the word out loud in your world, and because you'll feel the wrath of all kinds of things come down on you, I'm sure, just even saying the word. I'm bound to hear it just from putting it in writing. but when we've already cut to the quick, I have most of my schools are one teacher. How do I go less than that? I can't. So I have to have a teacher. A negative teacher or poor teacher or even just an average teacher that just isn't working very hard will close those schools before the count period. I swear, I had one last year. I'm trying to move a teacher around that isn't very effective and causes mischief. And when I suggested the name at a school site, one of the parents literally, and no exaggeration, fell backwards out of her chair on the floor. She'd had that teacher herself, years before, and was fully aware. And obviously, there was no way I was going to palm that one off. I have to move them around to keep test scores from dropping too hard at a school site for too long a period of time. I can take a hit for a year, and then the next teacher has to scramble for the entire year or two to recover from that one year where I've had a poor performance. I cannot get rid of them. I don't care what the union tells us, there's a system in place. Yeah, if they're a pedophile or a drug dealer, I cannot unload people for other reasons that are a problem. And if the tenure laws were changed, those very same people might even do their job. But they know they're protected, and they know I don't dare put them in those sites, so I can't. And, what am I supposed to do? Put them in administration? Create fluff jobs for them? We're not New York City. If you've seen Dancing, Waiting for Superman, that dance with lemons where you move them school to school to keep ahead of the vigilantes, we can't do that. I have no way to cover that. And, I just can't whack anymore without. And I've tried every possible way to do that. We tried a buyout when we had some of the federal monies we had, last year or two for, I offered $40,000 a piece for some of those in that range to just find someplace else to work. And you can't get them to go. They hang on by their toenails. It's killing us. And I know that's a hard thing for you to do, and we'll probably never get to it, but it's just difficult for us to work around it. The funding. And you gotta. And I didn't look at my watch, and I'm stressed, so I'm not paying attention. So shut me off. The one that's a killer for us is the school funding. I can't even seem to get anybody in the Department of Education to understand how this really works. But we have the safety net where if we drop 5%, we get a little help for the coming year. Well, it doesn't take into account by intent or by accident small schools that close. If Port Alexander should close next year. Because I have 9 kids, or 9.95, by the way. If I have a student leave the last day to go to a correspondence program, I tank. So now I've paid a teacher that I'm stuck with because I can't unload him now because I'm contracted with him. And once I sign it, I'm on the hook. And Port Alexander spent $40,000 on fuel for the year and whatever other costs, staggering amount of money. The next year, the way that formula works on that safety net is that they have it structured that those 9 kids now count to my next lowest school. Well, guess what? Most of my schools are 10 kids. So now I have 19 counting in another school somewhere. Well, there is no additional funding until you hit 20. It's a complete myth that there's any safety net for that. If my district drops 5%, that $380,000 that school would have generated, maybe I think roughly half of that would be absorbed somehow, but that's only if I drop 5% district-wide. There's no reason to think I'm going to drop 5%. If you looked at our chart, I mean, our population is stable, and by trying to give parents and kids what they need, we're actually increasing. It's you know, a far more equitable system in our mind, which isn't going to match anybody else's, but would it be do like a 90-80-70 thing? If I get 9 kids, give me 9. If I get 8, give me 80%. Something I can count on to take a chance. The second I talk about, even think about closing that school, if I don't say it out loud where they think they know what I'm thinking, parents with the means will begin to start an exodus. And if I don't commit to a good teacher, I've closed it anyway. If I have a Pied Piper there, kids will come. They materialize. Or maybe it's that they drift in, but they don't drift out, because we get a lot of movement. But they'll stick if you have a good school system and good program and good teachers. If I have a weak teacher there, which I have, the second I can't hire until August, because I can't take a chance, so I stall, and then who do I get? Well, I've killed it anyway. And it's happened repeatedly in our district, and it's virtually impossible to bring those back to life. I mean, I have to go to uncommon lengths to make that happen. And it's very complicated, and because people don't trust you on that. So something that would allow me to say, you know, I can make it on 70%. I mean, we just pull up or, you know, cinch in the rest of the district somehow, and I can get along. But we had a year several years ago where we lost 3 schools in one fall. We kept them open, but it drained every penny we had, stuck away for any kind of repairs. I mean, we had $500,000 in the bank, and it went to nothing. So it takes me 3 or 4 years to get back anything. We don't operate on a huge margin. If I can get 3% excess in a year, it's like a major miracle. I mean, we just keep enough to keep out of bankruptcy, because a boiler's going to blow up or a water system's going to fail. And we're constantly right on that edge. The difference between hero and heel is just absolutely microscopic, the same it is in your job. It's, you know, you're a hero when you get that school open with 10 kids, but if I hit the fall next year, and I can't know. Whale Pass is one of ours, and I just had an email last night with the teachers going, geez, I'm a little worried. Worst case, it looks like about 6. Best case, about 14. How do you plan for that? It's not physically possible. I mean, I can take a chance if I think I'll get some portion of it, but there's a ton of things that are staggeringly crippling for these small schools. But whether by intent or by chance, we have correspondence programs that can offer internet and phone service to a kid in a float house or a parent in a float house out in some remote site, which I can't do, and, you know, it'll close my school. And then we've done that. I have neighboring districts that'll send a bus into my district to grab kids. They can do that, and they do that. We've had neighboring districts pay for mileage for kids to come across from our schools to theirs. So a parent who has already working over there goes, whoa, I can make $200 or $300 a week on my gas if I just bring my kid to their school. Our schools, our boarding schools, you know, I lost a school 1 year because I had 3 kids going to Mount Edgecombe and Galena. Yeah, it's wonderful they want to do that, but it closes my school. You know, is that fair? I guess so, but it's pretty hard to overcome that kind of stuff. I can't predict those things, and a kid can decide that pretty late. But there's just a zillion ways. You know, the PFD coming out in October is like fatal. The year I spoke of, when we lost 3 schools, we had that $3,200 year between whatever that little thing was and the PFD. You know, had a family of 5, and it's like, I don't know if anybody still knows where they went. You know, but they got a chunk of change, and they just vanished out of Edna Bay. In fact, they never got there. I mean, they were, you know, on the boat there, and they, whoa, and they head the other way and left the state or something. But, you know, October's just a killer on that for handing out a bunch of money to people that think they're going. Anyway, so I should drop to close. There's plenty of stuff in the written commentary. You'll get me in trouble later, but I'll, if you have other questions, I'd be happy to answer. I'm sorry I've taken so long.
Yeah, if you ever stop being a superintendent, you could probably make a living entertaining education committees. Representative Puggy.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If your student count, the the ADM that your aid is based on, if you took this October's ADM and that was the number that next year's funding was based on, how would that help you?
And I'm going to try to remember this. Through the chair, Representative. So I was still worried about that. I'm not sure I can answer the question. No, that's a far better system. And Mr. Johnson had explained to me that one was up for consideration. And if you know, it is. It's a little worrisome when what if I were to be able to add one of those schools back that I've lost a year or two ago or something? It's a little worrisome there, because I'd have the burden of carrying it for a year until I saw some money for it. But at least I can predict what I have. That's a far cry better than what we have. I mean, no one with any common sense would open any of these schools. I mean, how do I explain that to anybody next fall when two or three of them crash because of something I can't foresee? If that answers that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With that, I'll go pitch that bill up.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions in the committee? Representative Olson.
This is reality.
This is reality.
And,
I love it.
It's scary when I can see these things and see what's going on, because it seems like it's really hard to explain to someone else what they have to deal with. And it's really pathetic that they have to deal with some of the things that he's talked about. But it's real, and it's happening across the state more than just in your school system. But when a district has that many small schools, it's a tightrope that they dance on all the time, and very frustrating, and hard on a superintendent's health. I mean, really. I wish that you could go and talk to every committee, including the finance committee, because they really don't understand. And I felt kind of bad because I didn't think that they talked to any of the little schools that are dealing with this. They talked to mostly schools that don't have to deal with that, and that was unfortunate, because it's just amazing what some of the schools are dealing with.
Thank you, Reverend.
Thank you, Lauren, very much for your testimony.
And we've heard presentations this year, and they've all been good, they've all been sincere. But I think you've helped us connect with the reality that that many of the superintendents deal with. I think I appreciate your candor. Representative Sisner.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And unfortunately, I'm not in a good mood. And part of my not in a good mood is the story you're telling is one that we've been hearing. And we've heard a small percentage. And I've been to a number of schools myself throughout Alaska and seen exactly this. And in communities that have a huge amount of benefit to the state, if in fact we could make sure that the schools were all right, this has been going on a long time. It hasn't stopped. And so this committee has responsibility. All of our committees have responsibilities. And we haven't been taking them. So this is one minority vote, and I'm in a bad mood. Thank you.
Any other question from committee? Okay. Thank you, sir.
Can we take 3 feet?
Oh, 3 feet. Back to order. We will have a presentation by the Alaska Tech Prep Consortium.
as soon as I get out of the chair.
Okay, Kathy and Diane.
Good morning.
Good morning. Please introduce yourself for the record, and also as you speak, each time we have two female voices, so somebody's going to have to transcribe this later. So each time you speak, if you would just say who you are.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. I'm Kathy LeCompte. I am on the board of directors for the Alaska Tech Prep Consortium, and I'm from Anchorage.
Good morning. My name is Diane Maples, and I'm the statewide tech prep coordinator for the Alaska Tech Prep Consortium. Thank you for the opportunity this morning.
So we're going to talk to you this morning about our work for the last 7 years as a Tech Prep Consortium and where the consortium is headed in the future, where we'd like to take it in the future. The first slide that I'm going to share with you has a lot to do with the work that we've just been doing. And this is one of my favorite slides because I refer to it a lot because sometimes we feel like we're all flying in different directions. And when you can look at what everybody's doing in an asset-based model, which is what we've done over the last 9 months, see what's going well, bring them together, link them, and leverage those good things that are happening, including funding and energy, people's energy, then the arrows all start flying in the same direction. And when we started doing this work and talking to others, there are pockets of greatness in this state happening that we have brought together to hopefully create some momentum to make a systemic change for our students. Just a brief history of the Tech Prep in Alaska. Tech Prep is a Carl Perkins funded initiative that's been in this state since 2004, and it was created by the Department of Education, the Department of Labor, and the University of Alaska. And the consortium model is what the Perkins funding required to have happen, and we had we have a consortium membership that is 44 school districts, the university, regional training centers, business and agency participants. And we have had great success, we feel. This data is actually from 2007. If you've had conversations about data, it's challenging to get good longitudinal data in this state. So what we can give you is we can give you some statistics. Mm-hmm. So since 2007, we had 35,000 students earn college credits in high school. And Tech Prep is about bringing a high school teacher and a university professor together, looking at their coursework, having agreement that if the teacher in the high school teaches this, 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 and this, and the student learning outcome is this, 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 and this, they will get college credit. They can get up to 3 credits. The beauty of that is it's $25 per credit when it's taught in the high school. So those 35,000 credits since 2007 that have been earned by our high school students equated into a little over $3.5 million in savings if the students were actually attending the university.
And if I could just add to that, this is Diane. That's savings in tuitions alone. That's not including books and lab fees and any additional fees that a student would generate by attending the university.
So we've done a really good job connecting the teachers in some districts and making those connections for the students. In other states, they've had great success in preparing students for secondary or college readiness, reducing the dropout rate, and saving students time. Because not only do they don't, in the gold standard, this is Kathy, by the way, in the gold standard, mm-hmm. Students get into this course, and it's not just a course. It's not just an elective credit. It's not just nice to have college credit, kid, here, we'll put it as your elective. In the Tech Prep model, the student takes a course, and it's actually 3 credits toward a certificate. So, for example, a student can take a welding course in high school that could give them 3 or 6 credits, depending on how many agreements are in the high school, and they have 6 credits towards an American Welding Society certification if they choose to go on to do that. So they have 6 credits of, say, a 9 credit or a 12 credit certificate, occupational endorsement at the university or training center. So you do the math on that. They pay $25 for these 6 credits. They pay college regular tuition at this, which is about 145, I think, right now, 142. So, but not only that, but it only takes them about a 6 months, or you know, a semester or a year to get it complete. So they save time, they save money. They're better prepared because we've been able to work with the students while they're still in high school. Now, anecdotally, I can tell you several stories. I can tell you a story about a kid in Ketchikan who came up to me at the Construction Academy and said, if I didn't find this, I'd have dropped out of school. I found this. They tech prepped my course. I took this course. He got 9 credits of an occupational endorsement in the Construction Academy down in Ketchikan and completed and met an employer that night and went to work. That's an anecdotal story. I can't tell you good data, you know, longitudinal data, because we don't have that yet. But we're so close. We're so close. And when that happens, it'll be so exciting because we know in our hearts that this is a working model. So here's the evolution that's happening in our tech prep world. The curriculum alignment with secondary, post-secondary is relationship built. It's with the teacher, is in the school district, is, you know, open and willing to talk and wanting to talk, or they have the resources with the university or the regional training center, then they make this happen. But if that teacher moves out of the district, then that articulation agreement goes away, the new teacher moves in and not real into it, so then the kids lose out. So because of these relationships, our kids are losing out sometimes on opportunities. So in 2009, the consortium had conducted a self-study and evaluation of what we were doing in our work and determined that we had done a great job with this curriculum alignment, but it was so relationship-built, which nothing wrong with that. It's all about relationships. But if you don't have some sort of systemic change, you don't have some sort of system that's there when the teacher leaves, then this all goes away. So we decided it was time to reach out, and we found out as we started to reach out, we were really the best kept secret in the state of Alaska when it comes to secondary, post-secondary outreach. So we have spent the last year speaking in front of the bodies, legislative bodies, policymaking bodies, superintendents, and bringing people together to talk about how we could build this system. So that's what we're going to tell you about right now. The system is focused on the student experience. It's a pathway for students. It takes students from the elementary grades into the middle school, where they are exploring and getting more awareness about their career options, giving a kid some ideas that there's something they can do with their life, giving them that hope, that idea that, yeah, I could do this, I could do this. And then in the 9th through 12th grade, that's when we start the articulation agreements, because that's when they're starting to kind of focus in on what they're interested in. There's still some career exploration. You know, it's, how do you expect a kid at 17 to know what they want to be? I mean, you know, I'm still figuring it out. So you give them that opportunity to do that and to participate in that. And I'll tell you, when the parents find out about it, they're all over it. They're like, yeah, you're going to, you know, this is what we need to do, and here's what we're going to do. And they're doing the math and encouraging their kids. They're very supportive of that. So we're built this system with the kids in mind. And this is kind of a wordy frame picture, but it's complex, but it's simple. It's about putting the student in the center. It's about bringing the employers in so that we ask them, what do you want to know? And this is workforce development. This is career and technical education that we're talking about. What do you want to know from the student or your worker when you're employing them? Not just the soft skills, not just showing up and being able to think critically, which, by the way, is also skills that students need to be successful in post-secondary education. So there's a connection there. We just need to learn to speak the same language better sometimes, because there really is a connection there. Looking at the curriculum, looking at the alignment in the curriculum, looking back, accountability, evaluation, is this really working? Is this really making a difference for the students? professional development for our teachers, getting them prepared to do the work of career and technical education, or even just talking with the students and helping them out with their career exploration. The technical skills assessment are things like CPR, CNA, AWS welding, those types of technical skills assessment, those national skills assessments that employers look for in their employees. This post-secondary and career readiness, we're trying to change the language from college and career readiness. Because when we say college and career readiness, many jump to a four-year degree. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about kids getting additional training out of high school to be able to go to work and to do, and then they go to work and then they might come back or they might not. So that's that post-secondary and career readiness that we're talking about. Then there's the guidance, counseling, and advising. And we had a big aha moment. It's not just the counselors that do the guidance, counseling, and advising. It takes the community to do that. And we were just talking the other day about how we can engage community members, Girl Scout leaders, pastors of churches, talking to kids and getting them engaged in this conversation. Teaching and learning strategies, particularly when we're talking about access. We talk about access for students. I was in Ketchikan for 5 years as a campus director down there. We went from 5 courses distance to 38 courses distance because we needed to reach out to the state and meet a need in order to keep our doors open for the community. And we also met the need for students who knew we were going to meet this need as great as we did, and now other university campuses have done that. So the teaching and learning strategy that needs to be taught is how do you do quality course when you're using technology. What does that look like? How do you know a student's learning? What are your learning outcomes? How do you assess that in the online environment? Then our cross-agency partnerships are very important. We partner with the Department of Education, the Department of Labor, working with them and accessing resources that they have. And then, of course, legislation, policy, and funding. And this isn't just at your level. This is in the districts with the school boards and the school districts as well. Did you have something that you wanted to add, Diane? I could see her moving out of the corner of my eye. I take a breath every once in a while, and she gets it. So this is what's happened over the last 8 months. These are all the organizations that have been having this conversation. We have a task force. Our Tech Prep Consortium board turned into a task force because we needed to roll up our sleeves and go to work. So we turned into a task force rather than a policymaking board. We suspended our bylaws and said, we got to start talking about this. We got to start working on this. And at the same time, the Alaska Association for Career and Technical Education started having conversations about this. They launched a leadership institute with 15 career and technical professionals from Haines to Nome, from Dillingham to Galena, who are having this conversation as well. And then the Institute of the North, when they met last November, they started having this conversation. And we put it all down on paper, and it was all around the Alaska Career and Technical Education Plan, which is the policy, is the strategic view of what needs to happen. What we have attempted to do is create the operational side of it. We've taken the strategic plan and said, here's what it looks like in a district. Here's what it looks like on the ground. And so when we looked at this, there was a lot of the same conversations going on. So we got everybody together and said, why don't we all just talk about this and see where we can work together? That link and leverage, remember that first slide with the arrows? Linking and leveraging, bringing people together, taking their strengths, using that asset model, and say, what are you doing well? Oh, you're doing that too? Well, here, why don't you two talk about that? And it's been a phenomenal exchange of ideas. So just for your recollection, if you haven't seen the plan recently, these are the main strategies that are in the plan: the transitions, curriculum, delivery models.
Representative Wilson, I'm sorry.
What does CTE stand for?
Career and Technical Education. Okay. I apologize. Through the chair. Sorry. Anyways, that's the Career and Technical Education plan. It's a collaborative plan that was built by the Department of Labor, the Department of Education, and the University of Alaska. And all three of the leaders of those agencies signed off on this plan. And if you haven't had a chance to look at it lately are interested in looking at it, it is online on the Alaska Workforce Investment Board website. So what we did was we took that program of study that I just went through, the circles, the bubbles, and we took the Career and Technical Education Plan, and we looked around at other states, and they've to some degree said we'll work together with labor and education, but they really haven't got it together as well as we do. We're really leading the way with that career and technical education plan. So we took that plan and we took the program of study and we overlaid it and we said, wow, this is the plan. So let's take a look at it. And we brought all those people together that were in that other slide that had been having these conversations and started looking at it. And what I'm sharing with you in this PowerPoint presentation is the big ideas. Lots of ideas, lots of things happening, but I wanted to share the big ideas with you for your information. The Alaska Career and Information System is the system that we are encouraging use from kindergarten to 12th grade for the personal learning and career plan for kids. They can get into it and they can investigate different careers. One of my favorite modules is called the reality check module. And a student can go in and say, well, I want to own a house and I want to have a car and I want to have a boat, and they get their lifestyle stuff in there. And then it tells the student or adult, anybody can use this system because it's free to Alaskans. And then it tells you how much income you have to have, and then it tells you what kind of a education or job you have to have and what kind of education it takes to get that job. So it gives you the perspective that you need. You know, if you've got this future and this is what I want, but how am I going to get there? So we're encouraging that as the personal learning and career plan. It's online, and there's trouble. There's still a little bit of trouble accessing it in the bush because of the internet connection, but we've managed to the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education are the managers of this. And there is a CD version. So there's a hard version that can go in somebody's computer. They don't have to have it online. But the beauty of this is kid starts it in kindergarten, and they're in fifth grade to this school, and then they move to this school. Well, this is online, so they take it with them. And they go to that school, and they get their new teacher, and they start talking to their teacher. And they pull up their personal learning and career plan, and it's right there. They don't have to reinvent it. And it connects with the parts on the program of study for guidance, and anybody can access it, and that's about all I will say about that. You can look at that. The website is there, and you can take a look at it yourself. The next piece is aligning curriculum. I talked a little bit about this. This is both horizontal and vertical. And when I say horizontal, that means you take a math class in ninth grade that builds on the math skills that you need for 10th grade math that builds on the and then builds on what you need to know when you go to the university or post-secondary. You need to have that level of math and English to be successful in post-secondary. If you're going to, you know, if you're going to work on a car or you're going to be a brain surgeon, you still have to know some math. Right. So that's what this model in the right environment will accomplish. And currently, I just wanted to share one of our current successes. We have a group of faculty from the university in the health disciplines that have been meeting for the last 6 months with a small grant that they received from the Department of Labor to align curriculum for five courses across the university. So a kid in Ketchikan can take a class, but they live in the UAS region, but they can take a health class in a health career pathway and walk over to Anchorage and go, and they say, hey, oh good, come on in. That fits in this career pathway, and here you go, and away you go, have fun. Rather than, gee, it's nice to see you, welcome to college, we'll put that in your elective bank, which cuts down on their ability to have electives. So we've got five courses that we're going to align that's going to open up these pathways. Particularly proud of that, because that has been a real issue for students. The next is e-learning and access. Like I said, I spent 5 years as campus director in Ketchikan, and providing access for students has been key in my world. I've been involved in the distance education conversation at the university for as long as my career. And providing access to students, particularly in this environment now where they need to have access to coursework that will help them achieve the Alaska Performance Scholarship if they're so interested. So how are they going to get access to a high-level math class if they don't have a highly qualified math teacher? They're going to do it online. So Victor Zinger, who's a professor at the university, has created his collaborative teaching model is what it's called. And it's like 3C² or something. Anyways, he has piloted that in Dillingham. And what that looks like is he sits in a classroom, Professor Zinger, And he broadcasts out to different places using video conferencing or audio conferencing. And he broadcasts out, and there may be three students in Galena, and there may be two students in Dublin, and there may be one student in Thorne Bay. And they're taking this math class from him. And the first semester, and this is a senior in high school, I think it's seniors, yeah. First semester, they're taking high school math. And then the second semester, they're taking college math. So it's this progression through math in their senior year. And the other beauty of this model is on the other end, there's a teacher supporting that student. That's the critical piece. There's a teacher on the other end. Students not just left to their own devices. And the teacher is learning the math concepts and getting some professional development as well. In technology, teaching with technology, as well as the math. So it's a good model. And there's research on that is working to prepare students for the post-secondary.
And this is Diane, and part of my salary this year is coming from the BTOP grant, which is the Broadband Technology Opportunities Program that was awarded to our state, one of the few. And part of my responsibilities is to partner folks together with this access in mind. How do we help students in our state achieve greater access to courses and programs and resources? And I know that there's a great deal of work happening. I think that the switch just got turned on in Bethel, for example. A lot of that groundwork for laying the cable so that there's greater internet access. And then looking at the possibilities. You know, listening to the superintendent this morning, we've spoken before. You know, if you put the student in the middle, really, when it's all said and done at the end of the day, and, you know, whether it's chemistry or auto mechanics or just career exploration and greater, you know, awareness of what's going on outside of a specific village or region, because they don't have access, they don't have the opportunity to get in and out. And we know that a lot of that experience and maturity comes with that exposure to life, if you will. You know, what does that look like? Is it possible to teach a class, you know, delivered from Mat-Su all the way into Bethel, you know, in the area of auto mechanics, because there isn't a teacher and there isn't a program and those resources aren't available? Or is it possible to think outside the box and find ways to, you know, out of Kotzebue, deliver to Anchorage career exploration in the area of mining, that a student in Anchorage, you know, probably has very little idea what in the world mining really looks like outside of just sitting in the classroom? And I don't want to box it in, but this is kind of where we're heading right now in this conversation about a program of study, or this, you know, making the connection to the plan. The elements that Kathy's talked about are best practices that are already going on in the state, and what we're wanting to do is look at how do we start providing the access to kids no matter where they are in the state to the best of our ability.
We have a good time together. This is Kathy. I want to go on, and I'm going to kind of rush through. I don't want to run out of time, but I do want to just hit this professional development big idea that we're working on is teacher industry externships, and that's where a teacher gets professional development credit. You send them up on the slope, and they learn how work is up on the slope, so when they come back and teach process technology, like, oh, that's why. Oh, that works. So that teach, you know, connecting again employer engagement, bringing the employers to the table. The facilities part of the plan, I'm asking that we stretch our minds out of the brick and mortar and think about technology infrastructure. That's where our students are going to get their learning in the future, especially for access. The brick and mortar part of it is going to always be with us. I'm not saying that it's not. But in addition to that, it's going to be the technology. So. And the students are driving that, and they're driving our need to be more collaborative. This is a Department of Labor Employment Training Administration term, braided funding. But if you just visualize what that looks like, you have somebody that brings a little bit of money, and they bring a resource, and they bring this, and they bring that, and pretty soon you've got this braided source of funding. And that, we depend on our cross-agency partnerships. Like Diane said, part of her salary, she's paid staff, I'm volunteer on the board. Part of her salary comes from this grant. Part of it comes from Perkins funding. And then part of it has come from my office for hosting some of these programs, hosting some of these meetings. So bringing those pieces together is what's kept us going for the last 8 or 9 months. So you've heard about the plan, and I know this is a lot of information. It's like a fire hose. But you've heard about what we're trying to do and make these connections, and we feel like we've got the framework ready. We're ready to go, and we're ready to implement it somewhere. So we're out looking for partners, and we want to implement it with a focus that that is important to everybody in the state. And not that these other ones aren't, but we picked health because that is a top job. There are new hospitals being built all over the state. There's a need for a workforce, and we're talking allied health, not talking doctors, nurses, rad techs. We're talking more about medical transcriptionists. We're talking about office workers. We're talking about phlebotomists, which is a 9-credit certificate, by the way. It doesn't take very long to get a phlebotomy certificate. So we're talking about those allied health programs. And we've partnered with the Alaska Health Workforce Coalition, who created an action agenda item, and we are in the action agenda. We have accomplished bullet one to the point where we're ready to go to bullet two to implement this in three local districts or three regions. So we're looking for partners to do this and to go into the communities and put this framework in place and bring them access. This is how that big group that was all talking, this is how it sifted out. This is our task force. The question marks in the middle, that's our partner. That's our district partner that's yet to be identified. And we're still looking for a few champions on some of these work groups. But they continue to meet, and we will regroup again on May 7th. To talk about our implementation strategy. So what's it going to take to succeed and make this happen, to serve our students? Well, first and foremost, we feel it's going to take someone to ask the question every morning when they get up, how's career and technical education in the state of Alaska today for our kids? What's going on? How's that happening? There's a lot of people that are asking that question. But they're asking it on their way to something else, to do something else, to say something, you know. So what we need is somebody who says that and they're on their way to check it out and make it happen for our kids. So, of course, we're going to need some funding to do that. We need funding to support that position, to support bringing people together, to support the innovative practices that we'd like to build on. I have skipped over the slide, but I just think this is fascinating that you can do CPR via distance now. Because they have a resusci-anny that's hooked up to a computer, and you do your thing, and it records on a computer so the teacher can be anywhere. You can send that model out anywhere and give somebody a CPR training. I just think that's amazing. Anyways, and it's going to take leadership. It's going to take leaders like you, like us, like school districts, like parents, to come together and say, we want to make this happen for our kids. Mm-hmm. And it would be our fondest desire to have that longitudinal database in place, mm-hmm. take this framework, implement it, follow those kids, give them a flag, follow them through time and see and get validation that what we're doing is really working. Because we do know in our hearts that it is. But sometimes people like to see it in numbers. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Representative Wilson.
I have a series of questions.
Go ahead.
First of all, I love your enthusiasm. I mean, that's what it really takes to get something off the ground like this, and you've both got it, and that's wonderful. I'm really excited. How many districts? So you actually, because you've gotten 5 classes going, how many districts across the state have gotten involved so far?
Through the chair.
Mm-hmm.
This is Kathy. We have 44 districts that have articulation agreements, course by course, teacher to university faculty. The 5 courses that are aligned now in health are part of this framework that we will put in to a district. I mean, the courses are being offered. But if you look at the, you lay them out, UAS, UAF, UAA, you wouldn't know it because they're all different numbers. But the content is the same. So we're trying to do that work up front. And so those courses are still available. But to create this system is what we're trying to accomplish. So those 5 courses will be there, regardless of whether the teacher's there or it's not. And in the best case scenario, one might be available via distance. Mm-hmm. So if there is a teacher there this year, but there isn't one next year, the course can stay. So those are part of that system.
Okay.
Follow up.
Okay. With that system, I know in our school district, in the town I live in, which is Wrangell, we have a fantastic math teacher, and her husband was the administrator of the hospital, and he passed away, and she retired, but they liked her so well, they talked her into working part-time just to do the math classes. And she's fantastic. And so I know how this works because it works really great in our school. It works wonderful. Some kids go away with 30 credits for college. I mean, I know it works real well. Have you done anything with Acklin?
This is Kathy. Yes, they're one of our agency partners.
Okay.
Roxy Morant was actually, we presented to the Senate Education Committee last Friday, and Roxy was in the audience last Friday.
Okay.
Yes, we work closely. We've been working closely with them because we are also working towards a new framework. The old voc ed model, you know, if you're not college ready, go to voc ed.
Uh-huh.
Well, that doesn't work anymore because you got to know math.
Yeah.
You got to be able to read it at a level that you can read the textbook, especially, you know, these computerized car repair places. So we have to look at it holistically. It's not just go figure out how to weld, but you got to think critically and you've got to be able to do a lot of different things. So we using Acklin's coursework to fill in a student's program of study, they have their math and their science and their English. And thank you for asking this question because I forgot. When we use this grid and we fill in this program of study for students and their career and technical education focus, we're also looking at which of these courses are APS eligible. So the kids are laying out this program of study. They're saving money on their CTE course because they're only paying $25 a credit. And then they're lining themselves up to get the Alaska Performance Scholarship. So done right, you know,
yeah,
getting close to real reasonable price for higher education. So
I'm
another question.
I'm real pleased to hear that because I know that they're working toward that direction, so that's great.
Mm-hmm.
So are you funded at all right now, or is that is your goal to find funding? I mean, how's that work?
Mr. Chair, this is Kathy again. We are currently coming to the end of our funding. We have some funding hope on the horizon. But right now, we have come to the end of our funding as Perkins money was zeroed out of the federal budget this year. So there is no Perkins funding for tech prep. Carl Perkins money still exists, and I am of the opinion, but nobody's been able to verify this, that they are, that the national movement is towards this program of study framework. They have tested this in 6 states in the lower 48. And so here's my hunch is they took the tech prep piece out because they want us to broaden our focus to this more systemic view with academic and career and technical education courses. And I think that there's probably going to be some support out there as well, but whether it comes in time. But with the group of people that we have, I think we're able to kind of keep the momentum going until we find some funding to support this.
How much do you need?
$302,000.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Have you been up in front of the House Finance yet?
We got here late this year. So by the time we got here, the budget had already been taken care of.
No.
Okay.
This week,
no.
This week they talked to all kinds of people about education, and that was going on this week. This is Friday. So
we did not.
Okay. I would suggest that you make sure that you visit as many of those finance people as you can, because even if it's just one-time funding, maybe we can get it into the capital project.
Well,
or something.
Well, may I just, the university budget actually had a line for this initiative that went into the governor's budget but didn't come out on the other side and then wasn't prioritized in the amended budget. But that line has been vetted through the university and been put in the university budget for 3 years. And to get into the university budget, it has to go through provosts and chancellors, and everybody has to say, yeah, let's put it there. But it just didn't make it, again, out of the camo book, I guess it is now. It used to be the red book, so which is the Board of Regents budget. So there is support at the university for it.
Oh, there's hope. There's hope. Don't worry. We've got to figure this out somehow.
And this is Diane, if I could add to that. And, you know, and with all due respect, you know, that, you know, the university has been very supportive to Tech Prep. What I think is really exciting is about our opportunity to take Tech Prep and move it into this systemic framework, if you will. So while the Tech Prep work is still going to go on, and there are folks within the university that are tech prep coordinators that we're working together. There's a large, about 16 of us working together as a statewide team throughout the campuses, as well as myself that sits outside of the university for the good of serving students to connect with the university, regional training centers, and apprenticeship, that broader holistic picture. And you know, when you asked the question about, you know, funding and what do you need, I guess I would also propose, you know, at some point, it takes agreeing on what does that framework and model really look like in the state of Alaska. How can we agree on a model that we can continue to move forward on at this level as well as at the local level? So I just wanted to add that for the record. Thank you.
I've got more questions, but I'll let somebody else ask.
Representative Seaton.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, you know, we've had quite a few discussions on standards and tracking and those kind of things, and it seems that what we have is the development of exactly what we were talking about, not mandatory tracks, but individual student tracks. And it. So I think that as the discussion goes forward, we ought to make sure that everyone realizes this is actually the implementation of what we've been attempting to talk about and do. And so at some point we need to be more concerned about making sure that we don't drop implementation in waiting for study. So I would just say that I appreciate you coming and the information, and it's, you know, the student engagement and individual student engagement, it appears that this is that piece that we've all been talking about, is that that's where you lose kids because they're not engaged, and the individual plan is where it really comes down to. You know, sometimes you can have a really great teacher that can enthuse the whole class, but where you're doing individual plans that can overcome that obstacle of not having the teacher that can absolutely engage the whole class at a time, and you lose some kids on the periphery. So I just appreciate this. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Diane and Kathy. Your timing is exquisitely good, because we have been having this conversation, and I've been making a vague reference to something that all of a sudden you show up with that which we've been referring to. And the whole question in my mind has always been, do we, of our students, one-third of our students will drop out of school, one-third of our students will finish in Alaska, and one-third of our students will go on to high school and onto life. Another third of our students will go on to either a two-year, four-year, or a certificate program. But of our ninth graders, only 7% are going to finish a four-year degree program. And my desperate concern is for the other 93%. What are we going to do with them? Just consider them collateral damage, and you have, I believe, the piece that I've been looking for. Anyway, we might disagree in terms of terms or how we would graphically describe it, but in terms of what you're doing and what we've been referring to, your timing is exquisitely good. Thank you. Representative Olson.
I agree with you 100%, and you know, we don't need to invent the wheel over again, you know, and you guys are right on with what you want to do, and we've just got to figure out some way that we've got to get this funded. We cannot wait. It's too important for our kids. We cannot wait. We've got to go forward with this. So We just got to figure it out.
Okay, any other questions? Okay. Good, but I really wish that you two would schedule with my staff, because I really want to spend more time with you before you leave.
Okay, we'll do that.
Thank you.
Thank you again for your time.
Oh, thank you. Okay. Next we'll hear HB 352, Resource Development Curriculum. I'll hand the gavel over to Representative Pruitt, and I'd like to make remarks on the bill, so we'll take a brief at ease.
Dick, please introduce yourself and your affiliation present.
And thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Alan Dick, representing District 6. And this bill is very, very simple. It's a very forthright, but I think it's an important bill because I've got quite a substantial constituent concern on the issue here. And just so I'll just go through the sponsor statement and see if there's any questions. It's an act relating to public school curriculum and textbook restrictions based on science, resource development, and sustained yield principles. And in the Alaska State Constitution, Section 2, General Authority, it says the legislature shall provide for the utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources belonging to the state, including land and waters, for the maximum benefit of its people. That's the Alaska State Constitution. But like many other states, Alaska has educators who come from various backgrounds who may be unfamiliar with Alaska's constitutional directives regarding state resources. The purpose of this bill is just to clearly state that the curriculum in local schools supports the intent of the Alaska State Constitution. Educational materials must give parity to the viewpoint of use and development, as well as conservation of all natural resources. Educational materials should recognize that the economic well-being of the state is totally dependent upon careful, sustainable resource development. And the constituents that have come to me have said we realize that we're not training enough teachers here in Alaska to meet the teacher need. And so as a result, we're drawing teachers from other parts of the country. And oftentimes those teachers aren't familiar with our Constitution. And if we're be aware of the even the Alaska the Statehood Agreement Act between the state of Alaska and the federal government, the Agreement Act said that realizing that there are not enough people in the state of Alaska to run the state government and to orchestrate the affairs of the state. If we taxed everybody in this state 50% of their income, there would not be enough income, enough taxation to run the state. So right in the beginning, the federal government and state government realized that we would have to develop our resources in order to be able to manage adequately and manage the resources in the landmass that is Alaska. And so we must then realize that we are dependent upon careful, sustainable resource development. And I'll be very honest. I worked in Red Devil Mine when I first came to Alaska, and I realized that, looking back, that's exactly how mining ought not to be. It happened in isolation, and I believe it happened in another era that was 45 years ago. And in this state, that we've recognized that there was problems, and I really believe that there's been tremendous effort to make sure that whatever we do is with total respect for the concerns of all the people and of the everybody downstream. It's not just how can we make money and leave the state. So I believe that the state of Alaska has made wonderful strides in the direction of responsible resource development. Unfortunately, we have teachers that are coming to Alaska that don't realize the breadth of our Constitution. So that's all I have to say, that we need to. So what my envision this bill is doing is not telling anybody to do anything. But what it does would empower the citizenry of Alaska, if there's a curriculum in their school district that's being taught that they feel is not showing adequate balance as stated in the state constitution, that they could go to their school board and say, listen, we appreciate what's being taught, but we want parity for, in the curriculum, so that our students grow up understanding that we are a state whose our income is desperately dependent upon responsible resource development.
All right. Questions, Representative Wilson?
I think it's wonderful because people don't realize that even in our university, mm-hmm. Is this cover not only the school but the university?
Representative Wilson, I never thought in that direction.
That's a good question. Fiscal note doesn't seem to state that.
I really think that it should cover the university also. I mean, that's just my thought. To education in Alaska.
Yeah, I think you're the governing body of each public school in the state, so I don't think it refers to the university in any way. I'm not saying I disagree with you on that. I'm just saying this part doesn't says.
Would you be open to?
I would, Representative Wilson, through the chair, I'd be open to any friendly amendment you'd like to make in that regard.
Well, at the proper time, Mr. Okay. Chair, I would.
Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just looking at the structure of the bill, it says that they shall base curriculum development and textbook selection on these principles. So if we have a biology book that isn't based on utilization of wild game, how is a school district going to be able to select that that biology course?
Representative Seaton to the chair. That's a good question because in my mind I would see a teacher being able to use a portion of the textbook and then balancing the curriculum with other materials. So I see what if I understand your question, you're asking, would we have to exclude a textbook because it didn't show Alaska's regard for balance? Is that your question?
Well, and that's it says they shall base the textbook selection on. It doesn't seem like there's any criteria there. It says that if it's not based on these, you cannot select it because you have to base the textbook selection on those principles. And I guess,
I wouldn't mind hearing from the department if they were available to kind of hear their thoughts on it. Maybe Cynthia, I know Cynthia's the one that wrote the fiscal note, and she just puts in the fiscal note, districts are responsible for their curriculum and textbook selection process. So it'd be interesting to see, you know, based on what she wrote in the fiscal note, her thoughts on that.
Thank you. Yeah. And, Mr. Chairman, I guess that is correct that every district is required to make that selection, but this is a state law that seems to, in the way it's currently done, restricts our ability to select those textbooks. Now, it could be that if you considered the curriculum K-12 and maybe you can say, well, in third grade they have mining, so you can have biology in high school that doesn't include hunting or harvest of resources or something, but I don't think that I'm worried about the unintended consequences as this is going to be applied to individual school districts and what that does to them and how that limits or and I think we're going to have to hear from them from school districts to know, because they're the ones that are based on selecting textbooks and how they read it.
Representative.
Representative Seaton, to the chair. I think that's an excellent perception. The intent here isn't to limit anybody to anything. I mean, we want minimal unintended consequence. I'd even entertain a friendly amendment that just that said shall base curriculum development and implementation on the constitutional principles, and that wouldn't remove textbook selection, and then they can pick whatever textbooks they want, and they'd be able. But as long as the delivery of the curriculum recognized the balance that's reflected in the Constitution.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If they were unable to get a textbook that showed parity, that then it would have to be supplemented with something else that would make sure that there that both sides were talked about. Because obviously there are both viewpoints in our world, and so we should be teaching what both sides say, you know.
Absolutely.
And at least the awareness that in Alaska, that one of the wonderful reasons that we don't have a state income tax and that we don't have a state sales tax is because we use our resources as that's where our revenues come from in this state, and and so we have to, because our Constitution says that we have to figure out how to do those things, and we have to do it responsibly and find ways to do it. I think that if we could get something in, I think we need to add some more to this. We might be able to leave textbook selection because there may be some. I don't have any idea. There may not be. I don't know. But that just put, if unable to find a textbook, then parity has to be taught in the classroom. Because I think this is a policy call for this state. And I mean, this is a policy call that we need to be thinking about on what we think should be taught. And I don't have a problem. I mean, I think it should be both sides taught, because we do need to look at our environment and make sure that we're keeping everything as pristine as we can in this state. But we can do that with responsible resource development. And
Mr. Chairman, if I can make a suggestion, maybe we should, these are excellent thoughts. If I can make a suggestion, perhaps you should just listen to public testimony, and after listening to public testimony, we can have the same conversation again.
Okay.
It looks like we don't have the people online that we expected to have on.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to throw a suggestion out there that I think might be helpful. Of course, a little bit of homework for the weekend. Then, Utah has a program that they implemented several years ago that is kind of similar to what we're talking about here. It's to help the people of Utah understand where their money comes from, because they have a considerable amount of resource development and those kinds of things that pay for their state. And so they put it in just a couple of years ago. NCSL might have some of the details, or I can get a hold of one of the representatives there in Utah that I've been able to work with that worked on it. It might be something to look at. I'm not saying that we have to model it against what they do in any way, shape, or form. But it might be something that we could look to see how they made it work appropriately with their standards. Because I don't think they... I see the concern that Representative Seaton has, and does it mean that we're going to have to try to find textbooks, and what if textbook doesn't have what we're looking for? And I think what they did is not necessarily a separate course of study, but they were able to maybe use the textbooks that are available, but then still teach the other items. So it's just something to, I'm just throwing it out there, something to maybe look at as a way to see if it works for us. So,
Mr. Chairman, yeah, I don't want, as a sponsor of the bill, I don't want to limit anybody.
Right.
I don't want to say we can't take Houghton Mifflin textbook because it doesn't have Alaskan concepts in it. Obviously, when I seriously doubt whether we could have any textbook in the United States that would that speaks to our specific needs. So, but as I look, we look down the road, I really believe that as we look at curriculum, most of our curriculum are going to be on electronic pads anyway, and so that's about to make a major shift, and we don't want to put any limitation on. So,
Representative Wilson.
Also, I would say to when you look at it, don't say our university, say all the teaching institutions in the state, because we have a state university, but we have other private institutions too. And can we tell them what to do or not? I don't know.
That may be tough. I don't know that we could tell.
I don't know that we could tell APU,
for example, what their curriculum has to be. I think their governing body and their particular accreditation organization could probably tell them, but I don't know if we could. But
okay,
Representative Wilson, so the chair, I'd like to stay as uncontroversial as
possible. Just a thought,
Representative Seaton.
Fine, and if you spread that too far beyond public school curriculums, you know, we talked earlier about a bill that was talking about private and religious schools and whether we can dictate their curriculum. With or without funding, so here's interaction that we might want to be careful of. The on line 11, you know, it's the curriculum development and all, and it's a utilization and development of all non-renewable resources in addition to the encouragement of balancing resource development and conservation under the section. And I think that it would be good to check with some of the representatives that are involved in a very high high-energy dispute on Pebble, because it would seem that this would, where you're saying utilization and development of all renewable all non-renewable resources, you may be signaling that the public schools have to, I'm not sure you're going to get the balancing act, because you're saying that it's going to be based on the development of all non-renewable resources in addition to balancing that with conservation under scientific principles. But there would be a question there of where that comes. So I just,
I didn't think of that.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, I think the intent here isn't to say that districts have to teach about this subject, but the intent is if they do, that which they teach needs to reflect the Alaska Constitution. It's not saying that that a school would have to teach, because we're not mandating. We don't have a science standard for the state that are actually tested. We have science standards, but they're not tested. And so I think the intent here is that based on science resource development and sustained yield principles, that if the subject of resource development, if the subject of resources is taught, that it should be reflect the Constitution. It's not saying you have to teach about resources.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess as you're quoting from the Constitution here, the legislature shall provide for utilization, development, and conservation of all natural resources. That seems to be a different focus than you shall the utilization and development of all non-renewable resources in addition to encouraging the balancing of resource development and conservation. Just wanting to have you consider whether those are the same parallel construction that is in the Constitution.
Yeah, and the comment I'd make to that is I don't think that we should shy away from this because we'd be concerned that a particular area of the state might not be for certain development. I still think that everyone should have an understanding of what drives the economy. Of course, we're having some of that discussion in our fiscal policy subcommittee, is making sure that the people of the state understand where the revenues come from, and making sure that they understand where most, you know, the jobs are, those kinds of things. So I don't want to shy away from that. I think that it's really good to make sure that kids and the tomorrow's leaders fully understand these things. So you're on the right track. And even if we're in the area, even, you know, and Representative Satan mentioned the Pebble and the concern over there, I still think that area, they should teach about the mining and let the kids decide for themselves. If they feel that it's still not something they can get behind, that's their choice. But I still think they should understand that it does drive the economy. It does drive the many jobs in the state. So how do we appropriately give them both views and let them then go for themselves? And I think that's kind of I think that's what you're getting at, and I think that's what we need to make sure the intent behind here, that it solidly states that. So go ahead, Representative Seaton.
And Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the construction of the bill.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that we should restrict the conversation one way or the other. I'm just saying that we have a bill before us, and I'm pointing out where I think there could be unintended consequences in the way it's worded. So I just want to make sure everybody understands that I'm putting forward those things so that they can be considered by the sponsor.
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I just welcome any committee input as to how we can make this meaningful and effective with no long-term consequences.
I think you're on the right track. Like I said, other states have done this as well. Eventually, and this is what we're trying to get the conversation going in our fiscal policy committee. If we need to start with the people that will be tomorrow's stepping into those roles tomorrow, be tomorrow's leaders, and make sure that they fully understand all these issues as well. So I think we're definitely on to the right track here. I appreciate you bringing this forward, Representative Dick. I'll invite you back up if there are no other questions from committee, and of course not hearing that there's someone online. So please come on up, take your seat, and I'll let you proceed from there.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Pruitt. And this has been a most fascinating morning. Maybe Mike, as we look back, it might be the highlight of my session. It was certainly refreshing to talk with people connected to reality. I've really enjoyed the previous presentations. So, on Monday, April 2 at 8 a.m., we will hear an update from the Mat-Su School District on graduation results presented by Superintendent Dina Paramo. The UA Board of Regents confirmation hearing, SB 170, Voc Ed Counseling in Schools, and HB 369, student participation in sports, and bills previously heard. And hopefully we can have an iteration of this one that we could could move. And with no further business, we're adjourned at 9:37.